and her name is Mary Burton Risley. She spent a month in Baghdad and recently came back in March as a member of the Iraq Peace Team, a project of the international group Voices in the Wilderness, which is a peace and humanitarian aid group. And just to tell you a little bit about Mary, she's a Quaker, a tax resister, the daughter of a United States Marine Lieutenant General. What's that?
I said I love it.
Yeah, right. A former preschool teacher, a hiking guide, and a lifelong peace activist. And she was the co-founder of the Los Alamos Study Group. And you may have to tell us a little about what that was. She may be familiar to people in New Mexico because her dispatches from Iraq were published in the Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Silver City newspapers, and also read on local radio stations. So that's kind of neat. And they were distributed by email to hundreds of readers around the United States and abroad. And I guess I'll let Mary tell you more about the work that she did while she was in Iraq and her experiences there. So, Mary Risling.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. I'd like to say, maybe I'll just hold this. It might be easier than bending over. I wasn't exactly a lifelong peace activist. When I was a teenager, I was a jingoistic, flag-waving daughter of a Marine general. But then I went to Berkeley. And which at that time was a really very fine university. I understand that all of your schools here have come under hard times because of the shift in funding away from human needs and toward the military in this country. Anyway, I am a Quaker since 1970, and as a Quaker, I believe that there's that of God in every human being. And last fall, as I heard the war drums beating more and more loudly, and I heard in the press this incredible demonization of a whole nation because of the acts of one person, I really was troubled. And I felt that because I'm a retired person, I live in a community, that I was free to go to Iraq and that I should do so. So I called up Voices in the Wilderness and was very honored that I was accepted to go there as a part of their peace team. Voices was begun in 1996 by a woman by the name of Kathy Kelly, who was a high school English teacher in Chicago, who'd become involved in the Iraq issue back in 91. And she was part of a peace camp on the Iraq-Kuwait border in 1991. And as she watched what was happening to the Iraqi people under the sanctions, finally, in 1996, she moved to Baghdad, and she has lived in Iraq for the last 7 years. She's learned Arabic, made many friends there. And she was joined in starting Voices by an Englishman, Milan Rai. And so it is an international organization. And their goal was to bring delegations of people from really all the countries, any country who wanted to send someone who was a peace activist and who wouldn't be a loose cannon there. They had to be kind of careful about who they accepted, to come to Iraq and look at the effects of the sanctions and go home and speak out and educate people to try and organize a grassroots movement toward lifting the sanctions, which we all believe, and she certainly believed, did not punish Saddam Hussein at all. In fact, they strengthened Saddam Hussein in a number of ways. Because the Iraqi people were suffering so much, he could pose himself as their champion who was standing up to the West. And so, you know, if anything, it strengthened him politically. But also, once the Oil for Food program was begun in 1995, it was the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein's regime who distributed the food. And by that time, between 60 and 70% of Iraqis were pretty completely dependent on that food. So you're not going to overthrow a government who is feeding you and you have no other source of food. So we tried to create a movement to lift the sanctions, and then when the war drums began to beat more loudly. People came who just wanted to be a compassionate presence of solidarity with the Iraqi people. And also for me personally, after I learned about the role my government had played in Iraq over the last 25 years, I wanted to do some atonement. I really wanted to go there and do what I could to make up for what my government had done. So I and many other people who went to Iraq over the last few years took medicines with us. And we knew when we went that just by going there, but certainly by taking two suitcases full of medicines, that we were violating U.S. law. And three members of Voices have been fined and threatened with jail terms for breaking the sanctions by going to Iraq. But all these three people wrote eloquent letters and said, we're not paying this fine. We're going to go on using our resources for acts of mercy and for acts of solidarity with the Iraqi people. And none of them, that hasn't been pursued by the government, so I'm not too worried about it. So I left for Iraq on February 5th, and I arrived in, well, I left on the 3rd, but it takes a whole day to get there, and then there's a day of getting your visa in Amman. So I arrived in Iraq on February 6th, and by this time, both the UN inspectors and the Iraqi people were pretty nervous. Dr. Blix and Dr. Albarade had done their first report, and the reception by the United States and the UK was disdainful, and the clock was definitely ticking. I'd like to just say that I think just as in our personal lives, if we want to get past a bad habit or a character flaw or an addiction of some kind, the first step is facing it. The first step is saying, okay, this is who I am and this is not who I want to be, and let's move on. And I think as a country, it's very important for us to do that also. And I really was shocked. I live in a very small rural area in New Mexico. I don't have a television. I read the New York Times daily, and I read The Nation and The Progressive, but you know, I don't see network TV or anything. When I came back and saw what was being broadcast on the airwaves here, it explained a lot for me about the polls supporting the war, because it was just frankly ignorant. It was just a lot of things coming over the airwaves being presented as the whole truth that were either untrue or so partial as to be extremely misleading. So I want to just go over a little bit of the history of our relations with Iraq. And maybe to start with, Iraq is not like ours, which came together voluntarily, all joining the Union around a political idea. Iraq is a cobbled together country by a colonial power at the end of World War I, literally lines drawn in the sand. And it was three of the caliphates of the old Ottoman Empire, Mosul in the north, Baghdad in the middle, and Basra in the south, except they didn't put in all of Basra. What is Kuwait now was originally part of Basra as well, and of course this was one of Saddam Hussein's justifications for invading Kuwait in 1990, was that he was restoring the territorial integrity of his country. Anyway, this country was a constitutional monarchy. The British occupied Iraq for 12 years, and they never were so glad to get out of any place in their lives because there was constant unrest, constant guerrilla warfare, if you will, during those 12 years. But the monarchy they installed, a Saudi prince who they had basically hired to come and be the king of Iraq, lasted until 1958. And there was a brief experiment of a republic from 58 to 63, and then a series of ever more bloody coups until the Ba'ath Party finally consolidated its power in the early 70s, and Saddam Hussein came to power in 1979. Well, the United States started supporting Iraq in the 1970s. And the reason we did that, I'm sure there are many reasons, but one of the main reasons was that they had a lot of oil, and we wanted to buy it from them. Another reason was that the ruling elite in Iraq is Sunni Muslim rather than Shia, and those are the two major branches of Islam, and it has to do with who was the legitimate heir of Muhammad. I mean, it goes back hundreds, thousands of years. And the Shia are 60% of the population in Iraq, but they have never, under the British or under the Ba'ath Party, they've never had any control of the country. Well, as long as it's been a country, they have been repressed and not allowed to, you know, exercise their, what we would call, legitimate political power because of their numbers. The Sunni are only 20% or 25%, and but they were an elite, and they were basically installed by the British, and they were able to hold on to their powerful place in the country. So since Iran was Shia, we thought, well, we don't want all of this oil to be covered, to be controlled by the same sect, and so we'll support this Sunni group to balance that out. And when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980, we supported him militarily. We had already built hospitals and provided money for agricultural projects and, you know, generally poured aid into the country. But when the Iran-Iraq war came along, we really supported him militarily. And that meant that we supplied him with biological weapons. 7 strains of anthrax in the 1980s were sent to Iraq. Chemicals and manuals for their weaponization were provided by the United States and also some European countries. We provided him satellite targeting data so that he could use these chemical weapons against the Iranian soldiers during that time. And in 1988, when the information came to the West that in a small village in northeastern Iraq, Halabja, had been found over 1,000 people killed by chemical weapons, there was a resolution in the United Nations Security Council to censure Saddam Hussein. And guess who vetoed it? The United States vetoed it in 1988. Then when Saddam invaded Kuwait, it was just this incredible flip-flop where, having been their best friend, we became their worst enemy. And we organized, as you know, Desert Storm, and we beat back his invasion of Kuwait. The United Nations is very clear about when the use of force is justified in international affairs, and it's Article 39 says that if there is a threat to the peace, a breach of the peace, or an act of aggression, that first nonviolent measures such as sanctions can be applied, and then if those are found to be inadequate, then the use of force is justified. So I'm a pacifist, I'm a Quaker, I don't believe in war at all, but clearly under international law, in 1991, there was justification for Desert Storm, but that was not the case in March 2003. So many of us are very grateful that the United Nations was able to withstand the terrific pressure that the U.S. and the U.K. applied to it, and they did not sanction, they did not authorize, they did not get behind what was clearly an illegal invasion of another country. Anyway, after the ground forces had been eradicated and the war was essentially over, the United States and the UK and France systematically bombed every electrical generating plant in the country of Iraq. They also bombed some of the major water treatment plants. And this is very serious because there are tremendous health consequences of bombing water treatment plants, or you can't operate water treatment plants without electricity, so in a way, it was a redundancy. And unfortunately, we knew exactly what we were doing, and I can tell you to look in the September issue of the Progressive magazine, and I believe this was also published in The Nation. There were some memos from the Defense Intelligence Agency that were released under the Freedom of Information Act, and they're just heartbreakingly honest. You know, they say that with the sanctions in place, 4 days after the invasion of Kuwait, the United Nations instituted the strictest sanctions ever imposed on a country. With the sanctions in place and with the electrical treatment plants and the water treatment facilities gone, that pandemics of disease would be released upon the Iraqi people, and that there's a very poignant sentence, that children would be the most susceptible. And in fact, what has happened over the last 12 years is that 1.6 million Iraqis have died, of preventable and treatable diseases that they were not able to prevent or deal with because of the sanctions. And of those, over 500,000 were children. Compare that to the figures about Saddam Hussein's brutal, brutal, brutal repression of any political dissent in his country. The figures I've read, the low estimate is 300,000, the high estimate is 3 million, but we're looking at 27 years. So under any of those scenarios, we, through the United Nations sanctions, have killed more Iraqis than Saddam Hussein did. I just say all of this, I love my country, and I love the landscape, I love so many of the people, I love our constitution, I love the achievements that we've made in this country in human rights and civil rights and so many wonderful areas, but right now I'm feeling very worried for my country, and part of the reason I went to Iraq was kind of a rescue message, a mission. I didn't think that we could stop the war by being bodies there, because the Voices mission is very different from the Shields. We went to be voices in the wilderness, and we wanted to be a voice in our own home countries for the Iraqi people. It's here that the wilderness is, not Iraq. And so I went to write, do a lot of writing, and to try and support the peace movement in this country in any way I could by making the people of Iraq real to people here by writing my experiences. And maybe we could just take a minute right now. I'd like to have 10 volunteers, because I have these wonderful pictures to show you.
So some of these people know, but I know, and I'll tell you a little bit about them, but these are just very typical, ordinary Iraqi people that you would see on the street. This man is a poet, and his Iraq guidebook belongs to the photographer, David Berrien, from Seattle, a member of our group. This was our shoeshine boy, one of several in front of the hotel, Hassan, and he was usually a very cheerful, you know, kind of a hustler guy. He'd just be coming out and saying, "Madame, shine, shine, tomorrow." But the photographer caught him in a very, very somber mood. This is a typical park or market scene, and you can see there are not too many women, and the women who are there are mostly in the chador. This is a woman who is sitting out in front of the Al-Mansur Cancer Hospital with her sick child. This little boy is standing at the gate of the Amaria shelter, and I'll show you more pictures of the Amaria shelter in the slideshow. And he lost a family member in the cruise missile bombing of the shelter in 1991, and he's picked some roses to come and put them on the shrine. This was taken on the day of the memorial service. This man right here is Father Yosef, and he is from Mosul. He's a Kurd. He's a Dominican priest who runs a large obstetrical gynecological hospital, a convent that runs an obstetrical gynecological hospital. And he's quite simply one of the most learned men I have ever met. And I went to a couple of pretty prestigious universities, but this guy speaks eight languages, reads 13 languages. He's just a wonderful guy. He loves to teach. Last summer, in the courtyard of the convent, he had every Friday night about 1,000 people, and he would lecture for about an hour, and then they would have a question and answer period. These are people who revere learning, just revere it. This doctor, everything I know about Iraqi medicine is in his face. I mean, doctors make today between $50 and $100 a month. One doctor I met, his father had to take a second job so that the son could go on being a doctor because he could not support his family on that money. So when the invasion began, I think the government and many Americans were very, very surprised at the amount of resistance there was in the first 2 or 3 weeks. And I think in order to understand it, we have to look look a little bit more in depth at Iraq. And, you know, we in this country value our civil liberties, we value our political liberties very, very much. When we talk about freedom in this country, we're mostly thinking of freedom too. You know, we're free to express ourselves, we're free to demonstrate, we're free to organize, we have a free press. That's what we think of.
But there's another freedom that we don't emphasize very much in this country, and that's freedom from. Freedom from want, freedom from ignorance, freedom from cold, you know, all of those things. If we really emphasized in those in this country, we wouldn't have homeless people, we wouldn't have, you know, people who don't get an education, we wouldn't have a lot of things that we have. So we emphasize freedom too, but the Ba'ath Party didn't allow any of those freedom twos, but they were essentially a socialist party. And so from the middle of 1970s, you know, 27 years ago, they began pouring the oil revenue money into programs of social well-being. And so what Iraq had achieved by 1989 was a standard of living about equivalent to Greece. So they were what the United Nations referred to as an emerging first world country. They were 49th in the panoply of nations, you know, 190 some nations. And they had achieved a 90% literacy rate. They had achieved a free universal education through the PhD level for anyone who could do the work. And that's why there are more Iraqi PhDs per capita than any other country in the world. They had achieved clean water and electricity almost everywhere in the country. They had achieved free universal medical care for everyone in the country, and it was the best medical care in the Middle East. So countries from all over the Middle East sent their medical students there to be trained. They sent their patients there to be diagnosed and treated. And they also had a law on the books, because although Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party members were Muslim, it was a strictly secular state. And so they had a law on the books that provided equal pay for equal work for men and women. The doctors I met, the teachers I met, they all made exactly the same thing as their male colleagues. So, you know, there's quite a few things on that list that we've never achieved in this country. So when people resisted there, I like for us to imagine that it's hard for us because we're such a powerful country now, we're used to thinking of that way, but suppose we were not such a powerful country and there was a larger and more powerful country massing its troops on our border, and this other country said, you poor Americans, you have 45 million people with no health insurance, you have 10 million hungry children, you have cities, inner cities that are bastions of crime and drug addiction and failing schools, and you have so much corruption in your political process at high levels that less than half of your population, less than half of your eligible voters actually bother to vote. And your current president was elected with only 18% of the vote. You poor Americans, we are going to invade your country and give you a better life. Well, would we resist that invasion? Of course. Some of us would resist. Well, some of us would resist it nonviolently, and some of us would resist it violently. But resisting that invasion would not mean that we were supporting George W. Bush. It would simply mean that this is our home, this is the place we love, and we would resist anyone invading here. And when I came back and the war began and I heard all this spin in the news media about how everyone who was fighting over there, all the Iraqis who were resisting, were supporting the Ba'ath Party and supporting the regime, I knew that wasn't true. But how do the ordinary Americans, you know that's not true? They don't know that. So I'm just going to 5 more minutes and tell you about the effects of the sanctions, because I think it's important to realize you've now heard where Iraq was in 1989, 1990. And now, having been at the level of Greece, they have a standard of living at the level of Chad, which is one of the poorest of the African countries. And one of the things that happened right away was hyperinflation. This is one Iraqi dinar given me as a sort of joke by one of the families that we visited quite often. And in 1990, it was worth $3.30. So Siham, whose picture you'll see, told me she could go to the store and buy some meat and some vegetables and some chickpeas, some rice. You know, she could cook dinner with this $1. And by the time I got there, this was the smallest bill that they printed, and it's 250 dinar. And we were encouraged to think of these as dimes. We were encouraged to think of these as dimes. So I'll pass them around. It's kind of interesting to see them. They're, of course, not worth anything now.
So the other thing that happened, of course, was unemployment. You know, that if there wasn't any capital to build anything or to replace anything or to fix anything, which was the case, and also if there wasn't any possibility of importing things to fix things. For example, the last garbage truck broke down in Baghdad in about 1996, so there's been no significant garbage pickup. There were some enterprising individuals who had private businesses to pick up garbage, but, you know, hardly anybody had the money to pay them to pick up their garbage. So they watched their beautiful city that was full of parks and full of outdoor monuments, full of fountains. They watched it just crumble before their eyes, you know, the sidewalks unrepaired. And of course they'd been bombed so many times too. I mean, they were bombed heavily in 1991, intermittently in the intervening years, every 3 days, but usually not in Baghdad. And then President Clinton bombed again Baghdad heavily in 1998. And of course, you can imagine, I can just barely imagine what the situation is now. But during the period of the sanctions, they just did not have the money to repair things. And they finally did get an oil for food program. The UN offered Saddam an oil for food program in 1993, but he defiantly refused it. But by 1995, the situation of poverty and starvation, literally in the country, was so severe that he accepted the oil for food program. And many people think that oil for food money went into the palaces and the mosques. Not so. I mean, I think Saddam, it's unconscionable that somebody who's worth a reputed $32 billion didn't help his people out with some of that money. But the oil for food money went into a bank account in New York, and it was overseen by a United Nations committee that had the same 5 veto powers as the Security Council. And all the money went there, and then Iraq would enter into contracts with suppliers, and all those contracts had to be signed off, checked off by the Committee 661. The United States used its veto power 1,500 times in that committee, and Britain used theirs 500 times. And there were two categories of no-nos. One was dual-use items, things that they thought could conceivably be weaponized. And some of those were quite surprising. I mean, chlorine is an obvious one. So they were able to get some water treatment up and running, 40 to 70% capacity, but the chlorine they got was donated by China and other countries, and it was not as good quality as they would have been able to buy. And many of the people who died from these waterborne diseases because they weren't able to get the water cleaned up. But, for example, milk powder, baby milk powder, was on the no-no list. Do any of you know why? If you've seen the film The Quiet American, which I highly recommend, milk contains phosphates. And after Oklahoma City, we know that phosphates can be made into explosives. So milk powder was rejected. Now, CARE... I'm trying to raise money for CARE because I visited their office twice in Baghdad, and they had a wonderful operation there, and all the employees were Iraqi. You know, Iraq is definitely not Afghanistan. There's just many, many people who are highly trained there. But they were able to import milk powder. In fact, they imported lactose-free baby milk powder because that would spare the children the diarrhea that sometimes is caused by milk powder. Anyway, the other category of things they could not import were things that the committee in New York decided were unnecessary. And those included textbooks. I'll read you the list here. It's kind of shocking. This is just a very partial list. Non-essential items were also prohibited. They include books, magazines, envelope and paper, coffins, light bulbs, shoes and shoe polish, toys, and wheelbarrows. They also would not allow things like pencils, because the lead could be taken out of the pencils, if you can imagine this, and could be smeared onto things that the military objects, weapons that the Iraqis did not want to be detected by radar. So, I mean, there just was a huge long list of things they were not able to import, and there were like $3 billion worth of things waiting
in, you know, of contracts outstanding that had not been approved when the invasion started. So hopefully, with the sanctions lifted, those difficulties will be resolved. But have to say one other thing, which is that the United States used a completely new kind of weapon in 1991. We then used it again in Kosovo, and we have used it in this recent bombardment. And those are weapons that are made out of depleted uranium. And depleted uranium is a misnomer. It is depleted in the sense that a very small percentage of the uranium ore, which is the fissile isotope 235, is removed, but the rest of the uranium is still half as radioactive as it was before U-235 was taken out. And the radiation, the half-life is, the radiation lasts 450 million years. That's 4.5 billion years, so essentially forever. And the problem with it is that the uranium is used because it's very dense and heavy and penetrates well, but on impact it's pyrophoric, so it catches fire and it aerosolizes into tiny little pellets of radioactive glass. And I understand they're as small as the grains, or I wouldn't even call it grains, of cornstarch. I mean, they're just very, very tiny. So they can be blown around, they can be floated in the water, they can get into the soil. And of course they're not particularly damaging if they're eaten, but if they're inhaled, they're 20 times more damaging because it's an alpha emitter rather than gamma or beta radiation. So what's happened is that the rates of cancer in Iraq have skyrocketed since 1991. And childhood leukemia, for example, is 5 to 7 times more common than it was before 1990. And whereas childhood leukemia here is a pretty treatable disease, it's about an 80% recovery rate now. In Iraq, it's really almost zero because they just don't have the chemotherapy drugs and they haven't been able to repair their radiation equipment because of the sanctions. So most Iraqi children who develop cancers are going to die. I have some drawings afterwards if you want to see them. I won't take the time to pass them out now, but I have some drawings that were given to me by the head nurse at the Al-Mansur Hospital by Iraqi children who were there and who have now since died.
If you can stand just a few more minutes, I'll read you an email that came from Baghdad on Easter Sunday. And I think it's informative because not that what Sattar says is necessarily true at all. I'm not convinced that it is, because I have no way of knowing. But it just reveals an attitude. Our dear friend Sattar showed up at our hotel in Baghdad. It had been over a month since we'd last seen him. And like so many others who are missing, we were fearful for his and his family's safety. He has 4 kids. Our relief in seeing him was great. After hearing his story, there was no doubt in my mind that it was time to leave, Mrs. Kathy. His was the voice we've been waiting to hear. "This is your country now," he said. He was inconsolable. He related that he'd gone to Saddam City Hospital to try and find 2 wounded friends. He didn't find them, but the situation there was so desperate that he felt he had to stay on to help the doctors attend to the wounded and dying. Tragic scenes that defy description. "You see many pictures in one moment," he said. Simultaneously, people were helping to cook or clean. Others were looting and killing. He stayed there for 12 days. Oops. He told us that he was going to try and get his former job back the next day, driving people to and from Amman. Initially, Kathy was appalled that this gifted civil engineer would go back to driving a car. He replied, "Nothing has changed. Only Saddam has gone away. Do you think a company that comes here is going to use me? They will never allow anyone to do anything in this country. They will choose one like Saddam to give orders." We parted with the request that should he get his job back, would he take us to Amman. So that just reveals an attitude. But I want to tell a couple of stories about the kindness and generosity of the Iraqi people. One of my little projects that I did over there was to have this wonderful definition of nonviolence that's on your handout from Wally Nelson, who's an American peace activist who died last year and tax resister, no tax since 1948. And I had it translated into Arabic, and I wanted to have these cards printed up so I could pass them out to friends. It's a wonderful definition. I encourage you to really look at it. But anyway, so I took it to this little tiny shop. Their only asset was a Xerox machine, and it wasn't a very good Xerox machine. But they said they could do it, but that they'd have to do it overnight. I think they didn't have enough cardstock. So we figured out how much I would owe them, and with the money, you know, it was like thousands of bills. And so I paid them part of the money, and then I went back the next day to pick it up, and I gave them what I had calculated with the rest of the money, and I was walking down the street, and the son of the father-son team came running down the street, "Madame, Madame, too big, too big." And so I went back, and they gave me back about a third of the money I had given them. I mean, these are desperately poor people, and yet they couldn't bear for me to pay more than they had the price that they had quoted for me. I would have never noticed the difference, you know. So then the other story is actually from the New York Times, and so some of you may have seen this. It's from April 21st, and it's about the doctors who took care of Jessica Lynch. And did a lot of you read it? I won't read it if you didn't, but I won't read the whole thing. But anyway, this reporter visited with them, and they talked about what it was like taking care of her and their role. And so Dr. Uday said, "I was very impressed by how brave she was. Even lying in her bed, she told us all she wanted. As all she wanted, aside from orange juice, was to get back to her unit. She wanted to wear her uniform again. She was also very truthful," he went on. "I asked her if she liked the Iraqi people, but she said no, she hated them. So then, I told her I felt like a brother to her," Dr. Husona said, "but she told me I was more like her mother than her brother." So anyway, they saved her life by moving her out of a private room into a crowded ward. And then when the bath party showed up to get her, the doctors lied, and they said that she had already died. And they said, "Well, where is the corpse?" And they said, "Well, so many people have died here, we just put them all out in a mass grave." And they believed, and they left. So then, when the Americans began to get pretty close, they decided that they would hire a driver to sneak Private Lynch in an ambulance to an American checkpoint. But when the driver drew near to the American troops, they stopped his car and turned it around before the driver had a chance to speak. So we waited. They did not have long to wait. 2 days later, close to midnight, there was a deafening explosion, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, they came in and rescued her. But at the very end, it says, "These days, Dr. Husona and Dr. Uday are struggling to treat Iraqi patients in a hospital lacking the most basic medical supplies. They have not forgotten Jessica Lynch. If I could talk to her," Dr. Uday said, "I would wish her a happy life." Dr. Husona had a message of his own. "I would tell her I miss her," he said. And two of my team members, 13 members of Iraqi peace team, stayed throughout all of the bombing. There's just two people there now, but more are on their way. Anyway, they began to leave. They lost their visas just before Baghdad fell. The Baghdad government said, "Nope, you have to leave." So they started driving on that road to Amman, but the United States was strafing that road, trying to keep people from leaving. So their car was going so fast that it turned over. And two of them were pretty seriously injured. One of them had a dislocated shoulder, and the other one had a big gash in his scalp. So what would happen? An Iraqi car stopped, two guys picked them up, took them to the nearest hospital, wouldn't take any money for their trouble. Then while Cliff Kindy was being stitched up, the doctor was saying, why is America doing this to us? And he too wouldn't take any money for stitching them up. So I just wanted to tell you, these are a wonderful people. And they were very upset when the American media and the other media, you know, just broadcast all that wildness from Saddam City, because Saddam City is like a ghetto of Baghdad. It's the poorest, most desperate, most criminalized element from the whole country. And I never met anybody while I was there who would have behaved in that way. So I'm glad to give you another little balancing picture of who the Iraqis were for me.
A collection of places.
Yes, well, I put on the table in the back little cards with the address of CARE. And whatever you send to CARE Atlanta will go directly to Baghdad. So I really encourage you to send money to them. CARE is much better than UNICEF, I think, because UNICEF isn't there. And besides, UNICEF may not be welcome there for a long time. And also with UNICEF, you are just as with Oxfam and the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, you're paying for a large overarching bureaucracy, whereas CARE is organized country by country. So there's no you're only paying for the services you get in that country, not for some bureaucracy elsewhere. So I think CARE is better. CARE is the best. But also, Voices needs money to send more people back to do what I'm doing. So whatever you can give will be gratefully received. Yes?
The KPFK is responding to this business about ending sanctions. It just legalizes an illegal war on the part of the Americans, and it also puts the Americans and the Brits totally in the driver's seat. And that's a very, very bad consequence because
I don't trust them either, but I have to just think of the poverty and deprivation of the Iraqi people. I think we need to lift the sanctions right away because they have so many needs right now. And I'm just praying, my prayer every day is that the hearts of our leaders will be opened. And I decided not to go back to Iraq. I really wanted to go back. But I decided that the problem is here, and I'm not going to go back until after the 2004 elections. Well, thanks for coming. And we just need to pray. And be sure to vote next time.